Hello from Midori House in London and a very warm welcome to Sunday Brunch here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Being served up today, forget real life, we strap on a headset and plunge into virtual reality with a man who says he's going to transform the way we go to the theatre. Also ahead, a new exhibition explores the underbelly of 1970s London. We hear from the photographer who lived and took pictures of the squats and rebellions. Also ahead, the joys of getting things wrong.
For millions of years, we've been a species that is evolving a big brain, which essentially took the pressure off of our bodies to be perfect because we evolved ways around all these imperfections. And that continues now with technology.
We ask why funny books never win prizes, and we embrace the clean eating movement as we meet the co-founder of what's being claimed to be London's healthiest bar. That's all to come this hour, live from London with me, Emma Nelson, on Monocle 24. We now are at a point where going meat-free has almost become the norm, and that's certainly how it feels here in London, where the rise of vegetarian and vegan eating has been meteoric. Well, one place which has embraced this is Redemption Bar. Vegan, sugar, wheat and alcohol-free. But apparently, it's a delicious place to go. And Catherine Salway is co-founder, and she's taken a time out from preparing her own brunch to come in and say hello. Thank you for joining us, Catherine, on this sunny Sunday morning.
Good morning.
Tell us a little bit, for those of us who haven't been good enough to go to the Redemption Bar, tell us what it's about and why you decided to invent it.
Well, we wanted to create a space away from all toxins and temptations, and our motto is spoil yourself without spoiling yourself, so you can't make a bad decision for yourself or the planet. The toughest decision you make is to come. It's all plant-based, super healthy, organic where possible, lots of nuts and seeds. We've stripped out the things that normally cause toxins and temptations, such as refined sugar, wheat, and obviously the big one is alcohol, because there's a lot of vegan restaurants around, but there's none that is actually alcohol free as well. So we have like an amazing array of cocktails. There's also lots of new drinks coming out, like Seedlip, Fit Beer, lots of, you know, packaged goods that are kind of about adult drinking, adult soft drinking. The whole market's exploding, so we're stocking those. And we're bringing out a cookbook, which is going to show some of the recipes we've got for these amazing drinks and canapés, so people get an idea of how we go about it.
Oh, I wonder what it was that made you think that we needed redeeming.
Well, I certainly needed redeeming. I had a big job at Virgin. I was eating too much, drinking too much. You know, I'm part of that demographic of women that really like wine and, you know, I've kind of got used to that. And so we created it really, me and Andrea, my partner, we created it really as our own redemption, but also the younger audience, they don't really need redemption. They're just sort of like being really responsible and conscious.
Well, this is it. I mean, I read recently, I saw a headline in a newspaper, has the gym become the new nightclub? And there's absolutely no doubt about it. If you walk down the streets nowadays, it almost feels as if there's a physical generational gap between the people who are arguably 30 plus, who are eat, drink, live, play, work hard, and will happily down a bottle of wine and then show up for work at 9 o'clock the next morning, arguably with three kids. And the people who are eight, you know, from 16 plus now in London, who seem to be physically very different from everyone else because they are lean, they are fit, they are arguably perhaps a little too obsessed with health. What would you say to that?
I agree with that completely. And I think the divide is around the 35 mark. That's where we see most of our customers are coming from, the under 35s. I guess there was a huge cultural shift that all happened at the same time, where the pub stopped becoming the kind of rite of passage that it used to be for us. And instead, social media took over. And this generation, they've seen their parents and their aunties and uncles getting drunk, and it's not cool, it's not sexy. Instead, it's sexy to be fit and healthy and to, you know, look good. They're ever so responsible, and it's everything that everybody wanted. You know, they said, oh, why can't we drink like the Europeans? Well, we sort of are now. It's got to be a good thing, right? I mean, I know there's a kind of backlash of people saying, oh, you know, these kind of like millennials and snowflakes, and you know, they're far too PC for their own good. But actually, you know, having a kind of consciousness about what you put in your body, the decisions you make, the effect on society, and more importantly on animals and the planet, is a really cool thing, I think. And we're kind of, you know, we I like to think at Redemption we kind of help to sort of drive the crest of that wave to make it sexy and cool for socialising to not be always at the expense of your health. And we've worked really hard at that. We've been doing it for 5 years. It's not been easy. But, you know, we're trying to say this is a really cool and sexy night out and you don't have to be, you know, tempted by wine and pizza. You can actually put loads of nutrients into your body while socialising, listening to cool tunes in a really nice environment.
It's funny you talk about things like pizza and wine as temptations, and I've never quite worked out why the stuff that does you harm health-wise is often discovered or often described as a treat. You know, when people talk about diets, saying, OK, it's kale Monday to Sunday, and then it's treat day when you eat crap. Yeah. And I wonder what it is about whether you're now changing a mindset, saying actually treats are stuff that does you good.
Exactly. And it's about, you know, putting stuff into your body like probiotics and kale and nutrition that actually activates you, energises you. I mean, certainly since we've been doing Redemption, it's the best cure for a hangover I've ever experienced is having a kale salad and a pious pina colada. And that will set me off throughout the whole day in a way that, you know, Nurofen never was able to. And so you can put all this stuff into your body and that's the treat to give to yourself. I wonder whether what you're describing is really the clever marketing of the food industry that has kind of said you're treating yourself by having a massive bar of Cadbury's, or, you know, you can treat yourself by having this lovely cold wine. And we've all fallen for all of that, haven't we? So we're trying to sort of like change that mindset a little bit.
How mainstream do you think so-called, you know, veganism, clean eating is now becoming? It's very much a part of certain pockets of London, at least. Mm. But travel around the world and we're not quite there yet.
I mean, certainly when I was researching the trend before launching Redemption, you know, when you see a trend that's coming through that's going to not be a fad but be a trend, you're looking for it to be happening year after year. You're looking for it to be growing from the youth in the cities, because that's where, you know, trends bubble from. And then it will start to spread out into the other cities and also into other demographics. And that's exactly what's happening. I mean, although our core audience is 35 under, I'm starting to see now more kind of like middle-aged guys come in. The kind of guys that 5 years ago were laughing me out of the boardroom to say, no, I won't be investing in that, that sounds crazy. Those guys are coming to Redemption now. So I think it's
looking possibly a little more but a little bit slimmer and a little brighter of eye.
Looking a little bit fitter, and you know, they want to look good too, because they want to have wives that look like Gwyneth Paltrow, and that's not going to happen unless you put a bit of effort in as well, mate. So it's just fascinating. And you know, to begin with, there's a lot of resistance to the idea, but now everyone thinks that we've sort, you know, some people think that we're just following a trend, but I like to think we kind of help to break it.
All right, so you've explained the reason why, but most importantly, what do you serve at this place? So, you know, one thing that I've never quite grasped is the idea that in order to do vegan food or vegetarian food, you have to replace the meat with something which is a substitute, like doing something as a veggie burger, or this trend now for bleeding vegan burgers, which just makes me scratch my head. Mm. What have you decided to do in terms of the food you serve?
Well, Andrea, who's my partner, the chef, her belief is in whole natural vegetables and in complex carbohydrates in their natural form. So, like, our best-selling items are sweet corn and red pepper fritters with guacamole, and we use the best avocados in the world. They're like our steaks. And, you know, we do a black rice risotto. We do a buff burger, which is made from beetroot, mushrooms, walnuts. We don't tend to use meat replacements because they're quite processed, not that healthy. But we have begun using jackfruit because it can behave a little bit like pork if you do a barbecued pulled thing. And we also put it into a rendang curry. So we're using jackfruit, but that's a fruit. So it's not like using, you know, seitan or, you know, soy or something like that. And then the desserts really as well. I mean, to create desserts that have got no wheat and no sugar and no dairy, that requires great skill. And we've kind of mastered that. So a lot of it is to do with cashews, which you soak and blend, and that gives you the consistency of things like cheesecake. You can use avocados and raw cacao to make chocolate mousses and things like that. So actually, you don't need to be consuming stuff like butter and sugar and cow's milk anymore. So, I mean, the skill for us really is to try and make sure we don't lose money doing all of that, because it's very labour intensive. The ingredients can be quite expensive. So it's been brilliant, really, because we've proven the model. And this has been the key thing for certainly me as a CEO, is to show that and then get more investment in so that we were able to expand into our, hopefully we've got a new site coming on in Seven Dials, Covent Garden, which I can't say too much about at the moment.
You just said it.
I know. Watch this space. And then obviously we've got a book coming out in September that I mentioned to you before we went on air, and that's a cocktails and canapes book, which hopefully should be stocked everywhere.
Catherine Solway, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. Now for a regular Sunday brunch feature, Weekend Reads. This week, Nathan Lentz, Professor of Biology at the City University of New York, joined Georgina Godwin to talk about his second book, Human Errors, A Panorama of Our Glitches, From Pointless Bones to Broken Genes. It's a look at the way in which we have muddled our evolution with issues as far-ranging as under-engineered knees, common to anyone who's been for a run, or the difficulty that humans have in reproducing. Nathan began by talking about our eyes.
Retinal design is very curious because the photoreceptors, which is what detects the light that comes into your eye, are actually facing sort of in a backwards orientation. They're tucked behind a layer of tissue. Now, I don't want anyone to think that our retinas are just horrendous. They're very efficient. They do a good job, but it's a very strange way to design it. So I think the story of evolution with our eye is that we have done a good job with a bad starting point. And that's really the triumph of evolution, is to take all these restrictions and constraints and come up with creative solutions through the randomness of mutation. But there's just no way it would have been designed that way intelligently in the first place, because it does make more sense, of course, to put the photoreceptors in the front and to have them face frontwards. And that is the way that the cephalopod retina, so the octopus and the squid, they have a very similar eye to ours, but in a more logically arranged orientation, which made a lot of things easier. For example, they don't have the blind spot that we have that's caused by the optic disc. There are some advantages to their eye to have it in that orientation.
You also look at our diet and the fact that actually we need a huge amount of vitamins and minerals, many of us, to exist in an optimal way.
That's right. And we evolved in an area of Africa that was really plentiful in lots of different kinds of foods. And sometimes you can say we were living in a salad bowl. So we had a lot of food just sort of served up to us with a wide variety. And we had to dig it up. We had to do lots of things. But here's the problem. This is really the lesson here. When things are provided for you, you sort of lose the ability to make them yourself. It makes a lot of sense. A body that's not constantly being worked out, being stressed, being pressured, will lose functionality over time. And that's what happened. So when we were having all of these nice, rich nutrients provided to us for millions of years, our body got very bad at making them ourselves or extracting them for ourselves. So what sounded like a great thing, which is the ability to eat lots of different kinds of foods, actually became a hindrance, because then we required a diet with lots of different foods in it. But if you compare that to other animals, it's really strange, because lots of other animals exist on a single type of food, or mostly on a single type of food, and they can be perfectly healthy eating only eucalyptus leaves, for example, if you look at the koala, whereas we really can't do that. There's no superfood for us. We need a very rich, varied diet, just because that's what our bodies got used to.
Going on through the book, now you debunk a lot of myths, one of which is that humans only use 10% of their brains. You say that's not true.
The myth of the 10% of the brain has been around for a long time, but no, we really use every nook and cranny of our brain. Of course, not all the same degree at any one time, but there's no sort of untapped potential in the brain that's going to explode anytime soon. I use that example to talk about the genome, when we actually really do use a fairly small fraction of the genome. Now, the fraction that we use is a little bit larger than we once thought it was, but it's still nowhere near half. Most of the DNA that's in our genome is not actively used. And it's not just not used, it can be harmful, and it's pointless. And that is a testament to our past, though. And that DNA, that useless DNA, has interesting backstories. And so in the book, one thing I want to make clear is it's not a catalog or an encyclopedia. I really chose the examples very carefully because each one of them has a story. an interesting evolutionary backstory that teaches us both biology and history, natural history of our bodies. So it's not just a boring list. It's much more about the narrative, about the story around each one of our flaws.
Mm. So, for instance, you use gambling to explore humans' very illogical relationship to valuation.
Yes, that's right. So both when it comes to numbers, money, and values, we make a lot of mistakes. And I don't just mean like random mistakes, but patterns of mistakes that we will make over and over and over again, and we just simply don't learn. And that's because our brains are wired in a couple of different ways. That one is we're not really capable of comprehending large numbers. So large data sets don't compute with us in a natural, intuitive way. We're very good at the math of very small numbers. That's it. The other way is that we measure resources in only a relative manner. We have no absolute sense of mathematics as a natural tendency. Of course, we can learn that, but we really only have an intuitive emotional connection to small numbers. And so that's why an anecdote has much more power with us than data sets. And data sets, of course, should be more influential. There's much more information. There's much more that can be learned from a large data set. But one interesting story will have more influence on us than a huge data set, because we can resonate with stories, not with data.
You talk about youth and young people being much bigger risk takers in almost every single way. Why is that?
That's really interesting too. So there's a concept in evolutionary biology called costly signaling, where especially males will sort of show off feats of strength or other little ways to sort of demonstrate their fitness in a search for potential mates. So by taking risks, what the subliminal message is, look how strong I am. I can do this dangerous thing and still come out okay. And this is unconscious, of course. Nobody does the calculation in their brain, but you're signaling to your rivals as well as to potential mates that you're strong, that you're tough, you can withstand all of these risky things and still be okay. And that applies to the tale of the peacock, to the song that the birds sing for days and days and days. You know, it's a feat of strength, and so is smoking cigarettes and drag racing and all of the other poor choices that teenagers make. One strong piece of evidence for this is that it is much more common in males than females, and you do grow out of it. So as you get much more into your mature state, you become more risk averse.
So that's personal evolution, but are we still evolving as a species?
We are evolving. Nobody really knows how or why. We know that reproduction is not perfectly equal in the population. So anytime you have unequal reproduction, you do have evolution. But it would be very hard to say what direction we're headed, because unequal reproduction changes from decade to decade. So how it looks now compared to just 40 or 50 years ago, so that's just a generation or two, is different. So I don't think anyone could tell you which direction we're evolving into. But one thing is very clear, is that we've been able to overcome our flaws. And I don't just mean recently, I mean for millions of years, we've been a species that is evolving a big brain, which essentially took the pressure off of our bodies to be perfect, because we evolved ways around all these imperfections. And that continues now with technology. So I think it is true that we've mostly escaped the forces of natural selection. People don't really die. In fact, most people that are born will live to reproductive age, and then they'll leave children or not based on their own choice. But that was never true in our past. So we have escaped the terror of natural selection, but we are evolving. We just don't really know in which direction.
Well, you end the book by saying that we already have the science that will save us from ourselves, but we're waiting for the will.
That's exactly right. So a lot of people are now blaming science and technology for some of the perils we face. And it's a fair criticism, because all of the threats that we now face are of our own making. If we experience a cataclysmic event in the next 100 years, it won't be an asteroid or a new competitor or a predator or any of those things. All of the problems we face are of our own making. And so the question is, wow, is this big brain actually a flaw, a liability rather than an advantage? And we have to, I don't know the answer to that, but we do have all of the solutions. There's none of the major problems that could bring us down are without solutions. We don't lack the technology or the scientific knowledge. We lack the will. And that's true for climate change, for resource acquisition, for overpopulation, for thermonuclear war, any problem you look at. There are scientific solutions simply waiting. You know, there was an Onion article not too recently where it says scientists remind the world that clean energy is just sitting there waiting, ready to go. There's really nothing stopping us from using it except for a desire.
Is this a cri de corps? Must we just pull ourselves together then?
Yeah, exactly right. So we have to, and this is why we get into these problems, by the way, is that evolution has never bred into us or any other species long-term planning. It's just, evolution doesn't work that way. It works one generation to the next. No generation was rewarded for its self-control and its willpower and its ability to think three generations ahead. That's just not in our brain. We don't have that. But there's lots of things that we're not born to do, but we learn how to do. So I think that it is a call to force to say, listen, we have these big brains. Let's start using them to think more than just for right now, for one decade or one generation, and think about the long-term health of the planet. Because if we don't, then we'll have the ultimate proof of our poor design. And that's the collapse of civilization. So we have a choice to make. The tools are there. I think every problem that science created, science can solve. It's just up to the politics now.
The hopeful sound of Nathan Lentz, his book Human Errors, a panorama of our glitches from pointless bones to broken genes, is out now. And to hear more from Georgina Godwin, check out Meet the Writers. You can find the full back catalogue online at our website. You're listening to Monocle 24.
Monocle has bureau around the world in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
It's such a big city, but I think also it's just one of these very layered cities. Most weeks there's something new to keep us interested, you know, either it's a new development or a, you know, really interesting new building, a new fashion brand. There's something about Tokyo, once you're here and you live here, it gets more and more interesting.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter, every day on Monocle 24.
Every city, no matter how powerful internationally and domestically, has its pockets where life is a struggle. And arguably, the higher the city rises, the bigger the gap between those who have and those who have not. Well, London is no exception. And a new exhibition by the photographer David Hoffman explores one part of the British capital, Whitechapel, an area which to this day is a mind-boggling mix of luxury flats, poor side streets, artisan cafes and street markets. It was very different, though, in the 1970s, wasn't it, though? David Hoffman, welcome to the studio.
Thank you. Good morning. There were certainly no artisan cafes. There was the New Bombay, which was one of my favourite restaurants, where you could get a meat curry for 3 and 6 or a vegetable curry for 2 and 6. That's 12.5p or 17.5p for the younger listeners. That was about the heights, I would say.
You've an exhibition of yours, of your photography, exploring Whitechapel in the 1970s, has just opened. It's on for the next week or so. And it's an incredibly vivid portrait of the people who filled those streets at that time. Tell us a little bit more about why you decided and in what circumstances you took these photos.
Yeah, it really focuses on two different aspects of Whitechapel. One was a squat where I was living from 73 to 84, and another squat just nearby that was evicted in 73. And the other side of it is a wet crypt at St. Botolph Church, which was a place where homeless people, street drinkers, totally lost and broken people could come. And they could bring their drink, they could bring their cider, their methylated spirits, their surgical spirits, and whoever you were, whatever state you were in, you were accepted.
What was it that drew you to those parts of London life?
Well, I was in that area because that was the only place I could afford to live. I'd just come down from York, from university there, and I was looking for places to stay, and Whitechapel was a very cheap place, and I had no money, so that's what happened.
And you took out your camera, and off you went.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about the photographs. That's the one disappointing aspect of radio, as actually, is we can't see them. So you're going to have to be our eyes for us. Who were you taking pictures of, and what were you capturing?
I was really capturing the life around me as I saw it, and being broke and really without much hope, no job, no hope of a job, really. I was seeing it from the point of view of someone who was struggling to keep their head above water. So those were the sorts of things that attracted me. There was a lot of squatting going on. I was quite active in that with a lot of other people. And we were opening up houses, putting people in, breaking the council tin off the doors to repossess the houses they wanted to demolish. There's hundreds of houses in Whitechapel and Stepney now that wouldn't exist had we not squatted them and kept the council away. So it was looking at them. There was also a move against private landlords who were keeping their housing empty because it was just more efficient for them. And there were people living on the streets. There were people, single homeless like myself, who were trying to find a place to stay. So this squat in Parfitt Street, which features in the exhibition, was one that was occupied when the bailiffs came. It was barricaded and the bailiffs couldn't get in. So there's quite a lot of pictures of people, just around there. And then eventually, of course, the bailiffs came at 3 a.m. and just walked in.
There are said that just walked in, and then what happened?
They threw everybody
everyone
out.
Everyone went home. That was the end of that. Things always end with a whimper, don't they?
Well, it wasn't quite the end of that, because the bailiffs put in guard dogs to keep everybody out. And one of the people who was involved in the squat knew some dog handlers who came down with a bag of sausages. And once the dogs have been fed, they think they're off duty. So, they're just relaxed dogs. You pat them on the head, they're fine. And then we took them down to Lemon Street Police Station and said, we found these strays, will you look after them? And everyone moved back in again.
You can only buy so many bags of sausages until the joke wears thin. But within your photographs, you have these wonderful moments of confrontation. I don't know if you can describe them as wonderful, but they're very vivid. It's a wonderful picture that you take from above, which is this standoff between squatters at Fieldgate Mansions and the police on the other side. And you just have this series of heads, the helmets and then the unruly mops of the people who are, who have taken possession of the place.
Yeah, and the big fat bailiffs trying to push through it all.
It's absolutely brilliant. And you have this sense of enormous movement and great life in that place. The photographs that you take are full of life and movement, aren't they?
They are. That was Parfitt Street, by the way, not Fieldgate Mansions, which is two streets along.
I'd better get my squats
right. just for the record. That was the time when the bailiffs were repelled. And what we'd done, I say we, but actually all the work was done by others. I just took some pictures. Was they put tin inside the door, corrugated iron, then an old bed frame, then a mattress, then more corrugated iron, then another mattress, then another bed frame. And so when the bailiffs came with their sledgehammers, every time they hit the door, it just sort of boinged in and bounced out again. And they just couldn't get any purchase on the thing. It just absorbed all the force.
What do you think of Whitechapel now, given the fact that at the time that you took photographs, the diversity of the faces on the streets was not remotely like it is now. It's got an incredibly vivid Bengali population now. And, the streets are filled with the smells and sounds of that community, which makes it an incredibly vivid and alive place to go now. That wasn't the case 40 years ago.
No, it was derelict, it was depressed, it was run down. There were lots of broken houses, empty bomb sites still, where the mosque is, was just open ground, just rough ground. It was just nothing like that. There were probably 50 or 60 single Bengali men living in ramshackle slums in old Montague Street. And then slowly they started to bring their families across as they began to earn some money. And that was the same time as the council was emptying Fieldgate Mansions. So we were opening up. The council would go in and board up a flat, smash the lavatories, rip out the wiring. And then we'd open it up, fix it roughly, and move some of these Bengali families in. And a friend of mine, Terry Fitzpatrick, was really active in this. He started the Bengali Housing Action Group. And it was just there, really, to find places for Bengali families who were living in awful slum conditions, really unbelievable. And really, the Bengali... the build-up of the Bengali population in Whitechapel really stemmed from that work then.
Whitechapel now is this amazing mix of areas. You do still go down the side street and get a feeling of what might have been 40 years ago. You do get these pockets, especially around the back of the big hospital.
Yes.
Because now Whitechapel, I don't know if anybody's ever been there, but it's slightly to the east of the city. It's near the city, which is where all the wealth is and all the money is made. But just across the road, you have this astonishing mix now, don't you, David? There is a huge rebuilt hospital in the middle,
yes.
But then you have these tiny side streets, many of which do exhibit great signs of still of a lot of deprivation. And then you have the Whitechapel Gallery, which is, an absolute, brilliant example of modern art and bringing exciting things to previously rundown areas. Then you have Brick Lane, which is a huge tourist destination in its own right. And then you now have the £1 million flats, which are now actually about £3 or £4 million. Yeah. What am I talking about? What do you think of the way that Whitechapel has been managed, if at all? Or do you think it has just been allowed to sort of go off the rails slightly?
Yeah, it's organic. I mean, at the west side of Whitechapel, you've still got the city, and with new buildings being made, you know, great tower blocks, shiny glass, all coming in slowly from the west, moving inwards, driving the population further east. And really everything that's happened there has just been a kind of instant reaction to the encroachment of the city. And the changes, as you say, are phenomenal. The flat that I squatted, little two-room, horribly hot in summer, freezing in winter, no bath, no bathroom, never mind, no bath. That flat is now on, I mean, not that flat, but those flats are now on the market for £600,000, £700,000.
And how do you feel about that?
Amazed. I mean, that's just, it's life, isn't it? It's London.
Well, is it life and is it London? Because many people say that London is unusual in that respect. I mean, yes, we have cities like Vancouver, Hong Kong, where the prices are enormously high, but the speed with which London has become out of reach of many Londoners is breathtaking. What's your reaction to that now?
Well, it's kind of sad. I mean, when I walk around the area, I liked it the way it was, but there are many, many more people there now making good livings, raising families, having a much better time than we ever did. So it's a bit mean to be down on it. I think you just have to accept that London is a very live, organic being, and bits grow. I mean, I think you saw the same thing, you know, decades and decades earlier in Hampstead, in Chelsea. I mean, they were both places that were really cheap and run down.
How do we make space for people who don't have the money to buy the £3 million flat?
We did make space for them. We don't. They're driven out. They live in really crap areas, bits, you know, the back of the armpit of Canning Town, or nasty little lost bits of Silvertown.
And the people who lived in these squats at the time, you didn't just have people who had no direction or no future. You had creative types, writers, architects, and yourself, photographers.
Yeah, and jewellers, silversmiths, people who work as mechanics, hostesses. I mean, there was a really wide range of employment. Because it was available. You could move in there. You didn't have to have money every week or be thrown out. So if you had a bad week, you could eat some friends' food and you know, stay there with a roof over your head till you did make some money and somebody else would come and eat your food.
And where do these people go nowadays?
Well, a lot of them have started their own businesses and have done very well. I mean, you've seen the Bengali families there have, you know, become a very tight-knit community and are very solid. I know some of the woodworkers, the silversmiths, the cabinet makers, and they've all, you know, worked for the last 40, 50 years, whatever, and have had a good life and made a good living. David, so it's worked very well.
David Hoffman, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. And David's exhibition, which has some amazing vivid pictures, is at Gallery 46 in London until the middle of the month, isn't it?
15th of August.
There you go.
Gallery 46 in Ashfield Street, behind the London Hospital. Come along.
I hope you've written that down. David Hoffman, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to
Close Sunday and Monday.
Yeah. Listen to Sunday Brunch. Let's hear now from this week's episode of the Monocle Culture Show. Robert Bound puts this year's Pulitzer Prize for Fiction winner under the microscope. The book is called Less, and it's by the American writer Andrew Sean Greer. When the book won the award, critics were rather surprised, not because it's not good, but because it's a comedy. Well, Rob was joined in the studio by the writers Andy Miller and Lucy Scholes to talk about why comedy is often overlooked when it comes to serious prizes and what makes this book a worthy winner.
I don't think anyone was expecting it to go ahead and scoop the prize. And then, because it was such a success, it was then published over here in the aftermath of the win, with everyone leading reviews going, what a surprise, this one, one of the world's leading, you know, literary prizes.
And we were kind of joking about it in the green room before we came in here, Andy, about the kind of, as you're saying, it's not well known for being a laugh factory.
The Pulitzer.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's really interesting, this. This book was published in the UK the week after the Bollinger Everyman Prize for comic fiction, which is awarded every year, announced that no funny books had been published in the last year, and therefore there would be no prize, apart from the one that won the Pulitzer.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm not saying that they haven't had their eye on the ball this year, but it surprised
bit of an oversight.
Me. It surprised me that the oversight had been made. The other thing I think is, the other point is worth making, is the Man Booker has been won in the last couple of years by really funny books written by American novelists. So The Sellout by Paul Beattie is a brilliantly funny book, in my opinion. It actually exhaustingly funny. I think you have to put it down every 30 pages and go and get some air.
Walk.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Lincoln and the Bardo, which is a terrific novel, but that's a funny book too. So there is a sort of, I don't know if three books makes a trend, but there is a very welcome move there to acknowledge humorous writing in literary circles, which, to be honest with you, does not happen very often.
So the comedy in Less is at the expense of our protagonist, Arthur Less, who's a down-on-his-luck novelist who decides to take up these invitations, as he said in the blurb, to kind of avoid having to be a guest or having to sort of be in the same country as his ex-boyfriend, as his ex-boyfriend marries his new boyfriend. And so we've got this kind of, we've got a nice kind of rhythm, we've got a kind of nice reason for him to bounce from city to city and have, you know, affair and relationship and weird aborted book reading and all these kind of different things that he does. And a lot of the comedy comes from, as I say, his expense, but also kind of at the expense of some of the self-importance of the literary world, the book world, what's expected of you when you stand on a stage. You guys are both kind of either fully in or partially in this literary world. How good is it at lampooning the world of books, Lucy?
I think it's very good. I think there's lots of it that is very recognisable, to the extent that I think when I first read it, I did wonder whether it would be quite the hit outside of the literary world that it is in. Because there's always that worry with books that
really
skewer
books about books.
Books about books, right? Because I get it, Andy gets it, but then does somebody else get it in quite the same way? However, I think it is very good at the sort of picture of the literary world, but I also think there's a lot in there that you can get.
It's very accessible. It kind of explains it, and it's like you're a guy on a stage having to say something he doesn't want to say.
Exactly.
Or,
And he's not. And I think also the character of Arthur Less is a very, he's very likable from the start, and he's not, I mean, obviously part of the comedy comes from the fact that he is not hugely successful. So I think anyone in a variety of kind of careers can probably, you know, sympathise and empathise with that. They don't have to be writers to get it.
Yeah.
The comedy is about status.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's a quote here really near the beginning of the book where he's doing an event for a science fiction writer called H.H.H. Mandan, which in itself made me laugh out loud. The writer is called H.H.H. Mandan, which is repeat. See, the more I say it, the funnier it gets. Well, right?
It is so about rhythm, you're right.
So it's about rhythm, it's about status. So there's a brilliant paragraph which goes, why him? Why did they ask Arthur Less, a minor author? Well, Less knows why. It's no mystery. A calculation was made. What literary writer would agree to prepare for an interview and yet not be paid? I think. And then it goes on to say it had to be someone terribly desperate. Right? So there's an ongoing, really brilliant joke, I think. Yes, joke. I think one of the engines of the comedy and the empathy in the book is that you're dealing with somebody who's doing what is superficially a role that readers of the book might aspire to.
Yeah.
He's a writer and he's on his third novel and he's travelling the world and he's appearing at literary festivals and he's interviewing famous authors, and yet at the same time, without bashing you over the head with it, here's this poor man kind of bumbling his way through these terrible things, a series of events which seem to have been hand-tooled to make him feel as inferior as possible. And that seems to me perfectly factually accurate in my own experience. My favourite line in this book is there's a brilliant bit in the third or fourth chapter where he, I think I'm right in saying, he's being interviewed on a panel and one of the other authors hasn't turned up and the chair says to him, it's okay, I'll talk about my work.
Yes.
And so the chair and he go on stage and the chair talks about his work for 15 minutes and then he turns to Les and he says, Arthur, now, we were talking backstage about mediocrity.
Andy Miller, Lucy Scholes and Robert Bound having far too much fun for this week's episode of the Monocle Culture Show. They were talking about this year's winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. The book's called Less by the American writer Andrew Sean Greer. And it's a book I'm going to go and buy tomorrow. You're listening to Monocle 24. So to begin today's show, we normally go to the theatre to experience the lives of others, the smell of the grease paint and the blood, sweat and tears of the actors. But it's not always possible to get to the front row and dive into the action, perhaps until now. An organisation based here in the United Kingdom claims it can, just by giving you a headset to transport you to the theatre and throw you right into the middle of it. The organisation's called Megaverse XR Theatre Lab, and Ben Carlin is the co-director, and I'm delighted to say he joins me in the studio to explain all. Welcome, Ben.
Hello.
I'm sure I didn't do a very good job of explaining what you do there, but tell us exactly what your project involves.
Yeah, the Megaverse XR Theatre Lab is all about exploring live performance and mixed reality technology. And by mixed reality, I mean kind of like virtual reality headsets and augmented reality as well. It's kind of a mixture of the two. Live performance in the sense of like the National Theatre Live, right? Where you go and you see the performance in a cinema, but it's still in live time and you're getting that communal theatre experience. But this is kind of taking it to another level where we're 3D recording the performers and then we're placing those performers into a games engine. And then when you've got the headset on, you're seeing those performers a bit like Princess Leia in Star Wars, like holographically. So you're seeing those performers in these virtual worlds.
What exactly are you seeing? I mean, I nearly got that. What exactly are you seeing? So, okay, take us from the idea of, yes, theatres and opera houses and performances are beamed across the world into theatres. Got that.
Yeah.
But then you take this one step forward. So you pop on your virtual reality headset. Uh-huh. What do you then see? Do you see what the actor is seeing? Do you see what the actor is doing? What's coming into your head?
So if you've ever been to like an immersive theatre production like Punch Drunk.
So you walk around.
You walk around and you explore, you have agency. Maybe you could look in a drawer and find some props. And it's kind of tying in those kind of gaming aspects, which immersive theatre draws from anyway. And then you kind of might come across an actor. And just like an immersive theatre production, like you can sort of interact with them. They can kind of tell that you're there. But we don't have the limitations of the physical world with this. So we can kind of, we've been using a program called Tilt Brush, which is 3D painting. So you have someone in a headset and they can make these extravagant worlds and these extravagant sets just by painting in 3D. And then we take those sets and we put them into the games engine and we put these virtual actors into the games engine. So what you're experiencing then is these mad worlds and these actors, and it's all in live time. And I think that's the important thing.
So this is all happening as you're watching it. This hasn't been pre-recorded.
Yes, that's it.
And the glorious thing is, I mean, how close can you actually get up to these actors? And then you can wander around again and potter off and go and have a look at something else.
Exactly. That's the kind of idea. Like, just like an immersive theatre show, you can kind of go right up to the actors. But kind of with this, obviously, because they're virtual, you could sort of step into them because they're kind of like ghosts in that sense because they're virtual.
Normally we have, you know, when you go to an immersive theatre and you walk around and you see the actors, they are performing a play.
Yeah.
What are your actors performing? You said that they are creating their own worlds as well.
Yeah.
I'm getting, this has got a lot of layers in it, hasn't it, Ben?
It
and
does.
I'm just trying to make sense of it because I'm very boring and I quite like to sit in an audience and see real people do stuff, but forgive me.
Yeah.
But I'm absolutely fascinated in the idea that you can create layer upon layer upon layer of experience, which sort of is supposed to bring you closer.
Yeah.
What are these people doing?
So this was a research and development project because liveness in virtual reality is something that hasn't really been explored that much. But imagine if you could then play with a sense of scale of the performers. So they're not just kind of human size, you could kind of make them giants. And so you're looking up at these kind of live performers, but now they're like 20 feet tall. Just instantly being able to do that is kind of like, oh, okay, so what kind of stories can we tell when we can play with a sense of scale, or we can instantly change the setting where, you know, we haven't got the rigidity of a physical theatre space and we can quickly flick between settings and that kind of thing.
Who is this intended to appeal to? Where are you going to take this?
Yeah, I've kind of made this kind of thing because it's the sort of thing that I would want to go and see. It's for people that might actually already be into sort of gaming and kind of computer games and that sort of thing, and it's an introductory thing for them to see, oh, actually theatre is quite broad and it can include this kind of thing as well. But I think people that are like immersive theatre and experiences would love this kind of thing.
Where do you think this is going to go next? Yeah. Given the fact that you can, you know, this has been a one-off project, hasn't it?
It has, yeah.
And when you went along to see it, what did people experience?
So, I mean, where I think it's going, I mean, this was funded by Arts Council, and we had a big team. We kind of had a technology partner that helped us do these volumetric recordings called Mimesis. And we did this through Sheffield Hallam Uni as well. They helped kind of put the whole thing together. But the next phase of this is having actors performing in Sheffield, but then you have an audience in London with the headsets on. And I kind of see people being sort of transported to these alternate kind of worlds. And you could kind of have this cross-collaboration between performers. So you could have a performer in New York, a performer in London, a performer wherever, and they could kind of not only create the work across continents and stuff, but then you can also watch it. And
how much is virtual reality now being brought into the conventional theatre world? Because I think it's a jump that many of us are going to inevitably have to take. And it's been used a little bit in theatrical productions and often to really, really boost the performance. But you know, is this something that we're just going to have to get used to?
There's been a lot of kind of work with theatre where you've had VR as an add-on. So you go and maybe you watch something in the headset first, or maybe after you go to the theatre. What we're trying to do is make something like that's platform native, that isn't theatre, that isn't gaming, that it's like a combination of these things, and it's creating work that works specifically for VR.
And how much is the audience going to be able to influence what happens on the stage?
Because we're doing this all in the games engine, there's like sliding scales of agency where maybe you're just walking around and you can kind of see the actors and you can kind of move. But what happens when you add more gaming elements in and you actually, you know, like an escape room type style thing, and you can kind of program in all these different things, maybe they've got an active role within the experience as well.
Ben Carlin, thank you very much indeed for joining me on Monocle 24. Finally today, we hear from the former art director of Time magazine, Edel Rodriguez. He's well known for his covers involving Donald Trump for that title and also for the German weekly Der Spiegel. The amazing pictures are fiercely political and could be considered the defining images of the Trump era. Well, earlier he spoke to Tom Edwards and they began by talking about his image of Trump with a headless Statue of Liberty.
That image, definitely there was a lot of reaction and a lot of commentary, probably the most about any of the images that I've made. And I think that, I don't know if it makes me proud, but it just makes me glad that people are noticing and paying attention to the topic. And it perhaps gets across the idea how serious this is, that maybe an artist would get to the point where they would make an image like that. So anything that makes people wake up and pay attention and get involved in what's happening is good to me. I think that's my main point, is just to get everyone involved. Because I think the biggest problem is that we start normalizing the situation and just think that putting little kids in cages in immigration camps is normal, or that the President of the United States would fire, you know, investigators, you know, things like that. Once, if that stuff gets normalized, then we're basically in a new fascism. And I think that's my main concern. And I kind of see it to some degree already, where there are these things going on around us. Kids are being detained, or they're giving psychological or psychotropic drugs while we're all just going about shopping and going to the mall and things like that. So it's a very weird and surreal reality. And I think you do have to wake up people once in a while to go, wait, this is not normal. We should not normalize these kinds of things.
It speaks to the power of the brilliant illustrative image that I think a single cover can speak more even than the best headline, than the best piece of op-ed journalism. In some respects, I don't know, it just feels like the perfect riposte for our times. I wanted to ask you that a little bit about the beginnings of your work, if you like, as an illustrator. And I know you've talked about your background growing up in a country, you talk about the heavily saturated colour, and I always think that's really interesting. Did that cast you into looking at things with a particularly rich illustrator's eye from when you were, I don't know, from when you were a really small child, do you think?
If I look back and think back, definitely I saw things very directly and quickly and in a graphic way. I don't know if I might have picked that up when I was a kid or not, but it definitely, it's something that I try to do in my work, because I feel that's the strongest You know, I'm basically trying to get people to understand an idea in 2-3 seconds. And I think that's the most direct way to do it, is to be as rich and bold and powerful, colorful in imagery to get people's attentions. And going back to, you know, the idea of how an image can have more impact than, say, an op-ed or a whole writing or a story, I don't think people necessarily look at information the same way they used to. They don't sit down for an hour and say, I want to read this 10-page story on what's happening right now. You know, they're receiving things in bits and pieces from the web, from Twitter or whatever. And I think a lot of what they're reading and their understanding is in these quick ways. And I think that we may have to rethink how we communicate ideas to people, how we inform them. Anyone that has already voted for Trump or kind of likes him is not going to sit through a page article explaining the issues. But if they can't avoid an image popping up in their news feed for 2 seconds or 3 seconds and someone commenting on it or their friend, so it's, or even people that are in the middle, they really can't make up their minds. They're busy with work. They're not going to be reading these long-form articles. So these images really, I think, have a bigger impact sometimes in getting people to understand issues and ideas, I think.
And what about the mediums themselves? I find it quite interesting. Obviously, you graduated with honours in painting, I think, from Pratt Institute. You obviously use digital. You do line drawing, printmaking, all sorts of things. And the covers are, well, they're that. They're covers for paper magazines, but they have an amazing digital footprint. Are you thinking about their deployment across various different platforms? Do you sort of see them in your illustrator's eye as being on magazines or newsstand, for example? Does it not matter how you look at them initially?
I really look at imagery the same way, whatever format it's in. I really look at it as you're 20 feet away from something, and I want to bring you in those 20 feet to get closer to what I just did. So if it's a poster on a street and it's very graphic and see it from far away, if it's about 2 inches on your phone, if it's on a magazine cover and you're at the bus station, it's this idea to communicate and get an audience's attention that is kind of going about their day, but it breaks through. I mean, I've seen my magazine covers on a newsstand with about 20 other magazines that are full of pop, fashion-y singers and high-gloss photos and things like that. And these covers, they just pop out in the newsstands or they pop out on the web with all that's happening. So I think that definitely goes across all mediums, and it's something that I thought about when I started. And even when I started, the idea of creating some sort of image or brand that would communicate very quickly with people is something that I thought about right at the beginning of this, probably like 2 years ago, that I really wanted a bit of repetition. When the image pops up, you immediately recognize the face and who you're talking about. And then you get into the concept or the idea and you read it within a few seconds. And that's something that creating a brand and then doing every, you know, once people recognize the brand, then you can do anything to it to destroy the brand, stretch it, you know, make an impact on it. So that's basically what I've tried to do probably since the primaries.
The former art director of Time magazine, Edel Rodriguez, talking to Tom Edwards there. You're listening to Monocle 24, and that was Sunday Brunch. Thank you for joining us here in London. It was produced and studio managed by George McDonough. Our researcher was Amber Roberts. Coming up, we have a mixtape on the Midori House Sessions, and we have Tom Edwards and Robert Bound standing by to bring us the Monocle Weekly. This week, they'll be hearing from the journalist turned comics writer John Harris Dunning to talk about his new work, Tumult. I'll be hearing from Journey Gunderson, the director of a new museum dedicated to laughs in the US, and we'll be finding out how The Dark Knight helped to shape the modern superhero blockbuster with the production designer Nathan Crowley. That's all coming up in an hour. If you're listening to this as a podcast, well, download it as well at monocle.com. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, thank you for joining us on Sunday Brunch.